darkly splendid abodes, the official podcast of Toronto Thelema, exploring, if you will, practical philosophy, from science and the workings of the mind to spirituality, esotericism, and magic. Stooping down, dipping my wings, I came into the darkly splendid abodes. The magical and mystical system developed by Aleister Crowley and George Cecil Jones, commonly denoted as the AA, consists of 11 grades or degrees. These in turn compose three orders. Edward Mason and I will take a look at these three orders and how they apply to the path of the initiate. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law.
Love is the law, love under will.
Welcome back, Edward.
Good afternoon. Thanks for calling me.
Yeah, how are you doing these days?
As I was telling you privately before we introduced the public to our conversation, down here in Mexico, we've been having dry season fires, so that's been a lot of excitement with helicopters buzzing overhead and people having to evacuate homes a few miles from where I live. But I'm okay where I am so far, touch wood, etc.
Yeah, hopefully that you remain safe and the air quality, obviously we don't want to see the fires consume anything valuable or precious to you, of course, but also I hope you don't end up with any issues with the air quality being problematic either.
We do. There's been a lot of smoky smell around the last couple of days. I woke up in the night two nights ago and thought, whoa, is the house on fire? And it was just the smell of smoke in that had come in the bedroom. Anyway, on to more profound matters than extinguished fires. Topic for today, I chose the three orders, which is basically the traditional structure of the initiatory bodies that existed before the Aeon of Horus began. It's best exemplified by the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, but it's been around for 200 or 300 years in quiet ways. There is a level of the thing that some people will call the First Order, the Outer College, which is basically working through the elemental degrees or grades, the bottom four Sephiroth of the Tree of Life. There you work in reverse order to Tetragrammaton, earth, air, water, then fire. And finally, you get to the element of spirit, which hopefully will draw or propel or kick you into Tefereth and the initiations that come at that point. Then there is the second or inner or Rose Cross College, or, there's all these different names for it, where you're dealing with the adept phase of things to do with the relationship of the individual to the divine, where the divine, we use the word divine as the best available term for what we're talking about here, but there's other terminology you could choose. That is about sorting out who you are on a much deeper level, because then you're getting into the transpersonal end of things. The first order stuff is sorting out really your worldly relation to yourself. How do I deal with life? How do I deal with myself? How do I deal with emotions and ideas and psychological tendencies in myself? All of that needs to get sorted out. And the elemental structure is a very effective, if perhaps incomplete, way of dealing with all of those functional dynamics within ourselves. And of course, finally, there is the third order, the masters and above, where really the personal self, it's still there because you need some kind of interface with which to interact with the world. You need some kind of way of convincing people you're safe to be around, but your entire orientation is going to be increasingly drawn to something beyond the concerns of everyday planetary life in this world. So those are the three orders, or the three segments or three phases.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the two things that have most fascinated me about this are that the second order, the adept order, which is Tefereth, Gevura, and Chesed in the conventional Tree of Life pattern, you're all constantly coming up against who or what you are, which is paradoxically deeply familiar and deeply strange because it is much more intensely about the essence of ourselves. And I think it can be profoundly alienating for a lot of people as they try to deal with the world as this is coming up. The second aspect of this is, and I think we dealt with this in another talk, which is where you could take the phases of life, especially Erickson's analysis of them, and say this is the phase of life corresponding to adulthood through to late middle age and the early onset of the senior years, where you're going through these phases of personal development. And this would happen whether or not you're an initiate or whether you're just somebody who's trying to figure out what life's about.
Mm-hmm.
But for initiates, and you know, this being a Thelemic podcast, I'm looking at people who are initiated or who are trying to get through initiation or are contemplating it and thinking, okay, what is it I'm going to be dealing with? And it's that strangeness of the alienating factor that fascinates me and often repels me still about what I'm doing. And I think, you know, why did I get into this in the first place anyway? Wasn't there something, you know, couldn't I have just sold real estate or maybe, you know, had a Tesla dealership before that one went sour? You know, just something that made life materially much easier and, you know, let somebody else figure out the meaning of life. And of course, maybe, you know, selling Teslas might at one point have been the meaning of life. You know, they're environmentally more sound than gasoline-driven vehicles, et cetera, et cetera. But that's not what I did. What has also fascinated me, I think, at the moment, we're seeing in the political situation in the States a large number of people who have some sort of pretension to a spiritual orientation coming up and pushing themselves into the political scene. And it strikes me that a lot of the people pushing this have themselves had an encounter to some measure with the deeper sense of an identity, but equilibrating that, actually, you know, getting to the point where you can say, it's okay, I can calm down, I can learn to deal with this and not scare the neighbors. You end up with a lot of people who claim to be pastors or priests or ministers, but really they're cult leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And they are desperately trying to push what came to them at a particular point in life where they had a profound and life-changing realization, but have not been able to develop it. It's why I think I've always had a very deep respect for the system of the orders. You know, first of all, go through a supervised training. Go through something that really makes you come to terms with who you are personally, socially, professionally, in terms of family and friends. And, you know, what is it you think you're after? And have you ever considered wondering why that is important to you? And is there more than one way of looking at that?
Mm-hmm.
So I think everyone has some sort of phase where they need to review where they are and review what they're looking at. But I don't know whether you've noticed that a lot of people come to this point and it's kind of a point of discomfort and perhaps embarrassment.
Mm-hmm.
What is it I'm after? And why, of all the things to get into, magic and Crowley and Thelema and, you know, putting on funny robes in order to do ceremonies?
I'll definitely question that from time to time myself as well, for sure.
you could have gone for the Tesla dealership, right? And up until 6 months ago, you could have made a bundle doing that one. And instead, no, that's not working out. Now, I think anyone who's had any sort of supervisory role, as I've had in esoteric orders, primarily for me in the Temple of the Silver Star, which has been my personal focus, but I shouldn't let people think that they should be held responsible for what I'm coming out with right now. Mm-hmm. There's probably some of the senior people shaking their heads, thinking there he goes again. Mm-hmm. You notice this pyramidal thing, which is there's this huge influx of people who really want to get illumined, and then you present them with not just a bunch of rituals and practices, but disciplined practice, which is always a bit off-putting, because a lot of people I found would come in and say, I hope you can kind of give me the skill of discipline.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's not available in that way. You cannot order it off Amazon. It just is not, it's out of stock. So a bunch of people will stumble and fade away, but a lot of others start coming up against themselves. I used to think it was just fear in the conventional sense of, oh my gosh, I'm looking into the darkness here. I think a lot of times, looking back, I found a lot of people who just seem to be embarrassed, because you want to be stronger, you want to be wiser, cleverer, more caring, more loving, more aware of the world and your role in it. And when you start realizing that you do it all a bit messily, and perhaps you don't want people to see that, the people start dropping out. It's a little sad that you can't get them to admit that they don't want to be seen as stumblers and fumblers.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, that's one of the things that you just come across, that I'm not particularly competent. It might be, you know, applying yourself to studying complicated texts or memorizing rituals. It might be that you're required to write papers, and some people can't do that very well. I have a suspicion that esotericism attracts a lot of people with dyslexia. No, really. And I've seen people that have uncomfortable about having to submit something, knowing that there are misspellings and odd bits of grammar in there because their brains don't work well with written language.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to remember that the person that you have met is not necessarily the same thing as the person who comes through on the page, because, you know, that's just a limitation they have in life. You know, some people can't juggle. I can't shuffle cards. So whenever I had to, you know, sort out tarot decks in front of other people, I'd have to stand there fumbling and, you know, twisting things in my fingers, hoping I wouldn't drop the cards, which I've done, simply because I don't have that kind of mental dexterity. Then you're going on through phases of actual examination of your own psychological patterns and projections and that stuff. Then you have to, you know, it goes right through the whole display of who you are as a person, what you've put together as a means of getting through life,
mm-hmm.
or as a means of being a successful Tesla salesman. you know, people start dropping out. It's a pyramid. You can draw the pyramid. You know, you get 100 people come in, and 30 or 40% of those maybe have just gone before they get through the first grade or degree. And that probably happens with the second one. Now, then you kind of get a diminution of people dropping out, because at this point, if they've been able to get through the necessary self-training and self-development for the previous levels, they feel more confident that, you know, given time and given a reasonable teacher who can help you, you know, you're going to be able to get through a bit more of this. So there's a definite dropping off of people for a while. But I think when you finally get to that stage where you're coming up to adeptship, and I had a talk about this with a very senior adept not long ago, who mentioned that just people seem to stall because the idea of allowing the strangeness as well as the remarkable intimacy of letting this thing that we generically call the Holy Guardian Angel begin to come in, it kind of leaves us speechless. It leaves us unable to address the disconnect between that private inner world that is very confident, very calm, quite enthusiastic about life. You know, it's directly connected to true will, the whole impetus, that factor of will. And then there's all these other things that we've, you know, addressed working through these early grades or degrees, but haven't exactly, you know, polished to a gem-like sheen. You know, we dealt with the fact that we tend to goof off or we tend to be sloppy about certain types of work. And I think people then sadly disappear. You don't see them again. A lot of people, though, will come back at a certain point. But when I say a lot of people, it's still a minority who can actually say, I need to give that another try. Mm-hmm. So the pyramid is already narrowed as it moves towards the summit. And going on through the second order, the inner college, whatever you want to call it, you are dealing with this strange marriage-like relationship while you're also trying to deal with the fact that the world is out there and it needs the rent to be paid and the tax return to be filled out. And, you know, you need to allow yourself to kick back with friends and kid around for a while and maintain sanity in most conventional ways.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, that is the thing I've personally had to deal with most. And I think what actually prompted me to this paper today, paper, if I call no, let's not call it a paper, these sketchy notes that I'm looking at now talking with you, is I still haven't quite worked out this particular relationship. I don't know whether you've got a comment here, because all the time I was pulling this together thinking, I'm not saying quite what I want to say.
Mm.
And I thought, well, hey, I'll ask Darren, what does he think of that?
Well,
he knows the answer.
Well, there's two things that come to mind. It's the type of thing, like, I totally understand exactly what you're saying, and I recognize the same kinds of patterns and things. And the two things that come to mind, one of which to start with is, when I first entered the environment, it was amongst the OTO, but the general sort of cultural climate, so to speak, felt like basically like there was this poker game going on where nobody really wanted to show their cards to everybody else. You know, it's like, yeah. So you go in and you feel like you have to kind of, you know, hold yourself in a certain way and keep your secrets and not really reveal how little you might know or how much and that sort of thing. So in order to save face. And I feel like that. And then on top of that, the other thing would be the idea that there's inevitably a lot of emphasis on one side or the other in terms of what kind of progress you can expect to see and how quickly you can see progress. So meaning right. Basically, it's very common to sort of naysay the idea that, well, you know, basically you're going to be committing to a big project here and you'll be lucky if you can achieve the KNC, much less anything that's beyond that, versus the other side of the coin where it's like, no, just jump in and start doing that right now and forget about that kind of thing. And I think these two sort of aspects feed into a cultural climate that affects the overall, you know, the way that people engage with the material and the way in which they may become their own worst enemy in one way or another, you know, just with this sort of unconscious capping off of how far they can expect to get, or this unconscious expectation of like how much easier it's going to be when they just start rolling up their sleeves and digging in.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. I, as you were talking, I had a flashback to before I was with the Temple of the Silver Star, I was with a similar fraternity in Toronto. And it just happened that the leadership we had decided to quit. And then it sort of came down to one other guy who said to me, look, don't worry, Edward, you know, I'm not going anywhere. So 2 months later, when he'd left... It was like, okay, that means I'm now the teacher of this group. And of course, I was still very much going through first order stuff. I'm thinking, how do I fake this? And I think that I ended up for years always in a teaching situation. Partly because, I mean, I did enjoy it and I did think I was, you know, doing better than some people could simply because I'd been around longer, but always with that sense of I'm faking this. So the imposter syndrome never, ever quit. Mm-hmm. You know, I was the warden of the Temple of Our Lady of the Stars in Toronto for 10 years. And there was always that sense of what am I going to talk about next meeting? Now, I'd sit down and stuff would come through. There was definitely, you know, the HGA was saying, don't worry, I'll give you stuff. But the problem was that this was not stuff that I had come across and fully explored for myself or was not fully able to live. You know, that this was a theoretical reality. I could see what it was about. I could understand that it all made sense, it fit with what Crowley had taught, it fit with the Kabbalistic tree of life, et cetera, et cetera. But it was not something that I'd personally been able to realize completely. A couple of years ago, I was sitting over a dinner with David Shoemaker, mm-hmm. and telling him, you know, this is how I always feel about it. And he sort of looked at me and he said, yes. The problem is that you're seeing this as a struggle. Why don't you just enjoy it? Wow, I was just thinking, no, I can't possibly enjoy this. I mean, this is my responsibility here. Of course, he had a point. Like the whole, you know ye that existence is pure joy, says the book. And yeah, that is real to me on one level, but actually doing the jabbering at other people sort of work was always stressful because I felt it's not a complete realization. And I would need to be really a master of the temple fully, you know, to just allow the HGA to direct everything with my personality, you know, like an affectionate dog running around.
Like the little red dog on the knees of the unknown. Yeah.
Yes, unknown, exactly. And of course, I was not at that point. And it's something I still deal with. I know that if I'm put in the situation of needing to explain something, I can do it. I can do it while admitting that I don't have all the answers. I can do it while admitting that I've forgotten certain texts, rituals, and exactly who's the archangel of the path of Samech, et cetera, et cetera. But it's there. And this development of this individuality, this adept consciousness thing, I don't know, maybe I'll spend the rest of my life caught on this one, because on the one hand, I accept that it's a reality. It just at times floats in and suddenly an idea or an image or a realization is there. But keeping it absolutely level, which seems to be what the masters are able to do, mm-hmm. seems to be. I mean, maybe they're having their own problems.
They're putting on their own poker game.
It's another poker game, yeah. they understand the stuff that I'm working on, but they're dealing with something else. I mean, another person that I believe has done the abyss crossing quite successfully remarked to me one time that really, you know, you're dealing at that point, at his point of life, where the realizations are happening on a neshamic level. Mm-hmm. And what do you mean by neshamic? Well, that question falls apart for you, because when you want to define what something means, you're talking about the ruach, you're talking about the self-conscious, analytical self that I used to pull together my notes for today's talk. It can explain itself, you know, this follows from that, and that relates to this, therefore, this is why I come to this conclusion, that sort of stuff. If you cross into the realm of neshama, you can sort of say what's going on, but it's often in almost like baby talk, because what is happening is so primal and so fundamental to things and so absolutely real at the most basic level that we can appreciate as, you know, discrete individual beings in the cosmos, that it gets very hard to put into conventional language. Crowley had to resort to the metaphors that you find in the holy books. It was the only way he could meaningfully put it there. He does give explanations at times, especially in his commentaries. But I think when something really hits you from one of those metaphors, it has a staying power that a conventional explanation doesn't have.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, having summed up the basic problem of existence in today's talk, there is still that phase ahead, because you can't not be aware that there's a further distance you could go.
Mm-hmm.
That however far up the adept scale of things you go, and very senior adepts and a couple of people that I've met that are either are masters of the temple or have indicated in some manner, maybe not directly, that yes, they went over the abyss and it took them a while to stabilize with that, have indicated that there's always a certain problem about being a human being with an opened higher consciousness to deal with.
Mm.
And it has to be dealt with a certain amount of humor. And I always think that if you wanted to identify what one of the so-called Black Brothers is, one of the people who's stalled and refuses to go any further, is they probably lack any serious empathetic sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
The most senior people I've met could always make at least lame jokes. Whereas people that you meet who are cult leaders, and where I am in Mexico, there's a lot of people who are cult leaderish. They've done a lot of yoga, or they did some powerful retreats and they had some shamanic experiences years ago. And they came to some certain conclusions. In 9 cases out of 10, they seem to be people who rather skipped over that first order work, that taking the personality apart. Oh, I didn't want to get stuck in the ego.
Of course, yeah.
Well, you know, that if there's one way to make sure you get permanently stuck in the ego, it's not, you know, getting your hands messy. You have to walk through the garbage dump before you can come to the foothills of the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it occurs to me that people who do ascend Everest have complained that the mountain itself has become a bit of a garbage dump, because don't want to have to bring all their trash back down, so they leave the food wrappers and, you know, the body wastes and broken equipment all the way up the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully it's not quite like that if you are ascending Mount Abiegnus and going to Adeptus and Magistracy, but... yeah, you're always having to deal with that ego stuff. And there are all these guys around, and a couple of women, but mostly guys, who will look at you with very wide-eyed earnestness, trying to convey to you the experience that they've had. And of course, it's completely useless to you or to me because that's their experience. Mm-hmm. I'm doing something else. And
it's amazing how firmly you can be fighting the ego only to find yourself trying to assert the ego so strongly and impress it on others.
Honestly, I have one friend here, lovely person, who is always going on about, you know, how to defeat the ego. She's introduced this in small talk and, you know, at somebody's birthday party. How are you doing? All fine. I'm still battling with the ego. And I think, I'm just battling with, you know, a leak in my roof. I've always wanted to have a heartfelt discussion with her and say, you realize that your obsession with getting beyond the ego is the one thing that is probably anchoring the ego there. You need some ego around, because how could you be talking to me without something that identifies with the regular human state? But yeah, you have to, in order to bypass the dominance of the ego, the power it has over us, you have to have messed around with the way you've put your personality together and realize that, okay, well, that works for me. It's okay. It's a toolkit. But, you know, I've got to remember that it is just the toolkit. And I've got greater ambitions to deal with beyond that particular thing.
Yeah, I think I remember a huge breakthrough moment for me was actually when there was a time early on, I'd only been around with this previous order before the Temple of Our Lady of the Stars for a brief period. And you had asked me if how I would respond if I was asked to take on an officer role. And I said, well, my ego would be really pleased by that, but I don't know if that's a good thing. And your response was roughly that, like along those lines of, a magician needs an ego, and the ego is not a bad thing. So that helped me to put it into the perspective of the ego being essentially a tool and having its place within the overall structure of the individual.
I'm glad I'd already transcended mundane preoccupations in life and was able to just...
So what are you doing coming back here for?
Oh, dear. We better watch it, or this podcast is going to turn into an in-joke. Anyway, what just fascinated me, the more I looked at this, from the moment the idea popped into my head, it was just, there is this constant movement towards some, as I said before, but it's worth repeating, something that is profoundly essential, profoundly central, profoundly immediate within ourselves, that we are trying to get to and introduce into life. And at the same time, it has its own agenda, which is going to take us into some pretty odd headspaces. Mm-hmm. And that's why, you know, they always say to people who are about to have, who've just gone through KNC, go and isolate for a few weeks. Because you're really, really going to come out with stuff that you think is amazing and is going to make people think you're very odd. Mm-hmm. Why? Because you are very odd.
And there's no sense of proportion initially with those kinds of, you know, breakthroughs as well. So
the other thing that was going through my mind in connection with what we've been talking about is that right now, you know, we're recording this at the end of March in the mundane year of 2025, tremendous confusion and a breakdown of the order of society that's been around in the Western world and more broadly for decades. And it seems to me that this is one of those times when being an initiate or aiming for initiation or maintaining an initiated view of things is more important than ever. Mm-hmm. Now, you can't come up with the answers. You know, 25 times a day, I see somebody posting something that this explains what's happening, this explains this particular individual and their strengths or their failings or their evil nature. Mm. And I can't remember a quarter of them. But the whole thing about initiation is that it puts you into this relationship with something that is looking very closely at the world, but is also stepped back from it. The mystery schools, I think, have a role here in not getting themselves politically entangled. One of the things that brought down the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn was MacGregor Mathers trying to get involved with bringing back the French monarchy and stuff like that. I mean, it took them away from their core task, which was producing adepts, producing writers, poets, thinkers, philosophers, cool people. Mm-hmm. You know, the world always needs more and more cool people, oddballs who find a way to become comfortable with their oddness. And that's a key function of a mystery school. Why do you join this particular bunch of weird people? Because I felt comfortable being me on the basis of that membership. Whether you do get through the full adept phase and find yourself staring into the abyss or not is not so much the ultimate concern as simply being committed to a life course that is not totally enmeshed with the absurdities and panics of the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of impressed at the moment by my Mexican neighbors. I mean, they're very much entangled with tariffs, political pressures, et cetera, and there's a kind of it's a sneering attitude, but it's also a bit of a shrug. Partly because Mexico's relationship with the United States has been fraught for 200 years. Mexico has never been respected by its northern neighbor. And as a result, there's always been a sense of, on the one hand, a certain jealousy and admiration for the states, and on the other hand, a resentment that it's not possible to be simply respected for being a different thing.
Mm-hmm.
Don't want to go too far into all of that, because then I'd be contradicting the point I'm trying to make, but it seems that there is a stronger ability with the people around me to say, well, that's how it is.
Mm-hmm.
We've been dealing with these guys on this way for a long time. And I'm impressed by that kind of stoicism that I'm seeing. And I think you need a touch of that stoicism to get you to the more detached viewpoint of the adept who says, well, we're in a stage of chaos at the moment. We're always warned that this aeon is going to be one of war and conflict. It's not, it's going to be an easy ride. We've always had to say to people, we are not the advocates of the age of Aquarius, and we all join hands and sing, sing the age of Aquarius. That ain't where we feel things are headed. The crisis itself appears to be a crisis because we are not standing far enough back from historical process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a little bit like seeing things just from the particular point of view of a piece on the chessboard instead of being able to stand up above and see the overall chess game at play.
I like that metaphor. I'll steal it. the whole game is in play and it will keep on being played out a long time into the future. Everyone these days concludes that statement of assuming we haven't destroyed the planet, which, admittedly is a concern. But I think that some form of humanity is going to be around for quite a long time, cohabiting or otherwise with artificial intelligence.
Mm-hmm. But cockroaches and tax collectors and humanity.
Yeah, there may be a few visiting aliens as well, trying to see, this is what we're up to these days. But definitely the tax collectors will persist, unless, they've all been chainsawed out of a job. That is a requirement. It's not part of the job of being an initiate. The job of initiates is to train other initiates. What each person separately from their participation in their order accomplishes is intimately interwoven with their esoteric practice, but obviously is also separate because we each have a role in the world. Some people are artists, some people are writers, some people do other stuff, quite a range of other stuff. But that detachment, I think, is a critical part of what initiation tries to teach us. And the rougher ordeals are part of attaining that detachment. That whole thing I was talking about earlier about the embarrassment of going through certain things where you admit that you have a vulnerability, a weakness, a tendency, a self-image that you don't feel you really want to discuss with anyone else, which means you really don't want to discuss it with yourself. Mm-hmm. That is one of the things that mystery system confronts us with very rapidly. A lot of people, as I said, just are not able to take that on. It's more than they were expecting. It's too intimately real for them to dive straight into. But it's an essential first phase, and that, you know, is a phase that in the mystery schools takes years as opposed to months to work through. And it's always with you. You know, there are always aspects of yourself that never quite got deprogrammed, never quite got uprooted, or they keep rerouting themselves. I didn't use it when I was talking earlier, but one metaphor that came to me was like trying to swim across the bay, and finally you think, I've made it to the other shore, and you realize you're actually, you know, 20 yards down the beach from where you started. You're still the same person, living the same life with the same personal history and the same mundane ambitions as you've always had. That one can be, I find, certainly looking at it from the later years of my life now, thinking, you know, why didn't I go further? And I did not ever dream of running a Tesla dealership because I'm a terrible salesman. But there were things that I was going to accomplish when I set out that I've not entirely left unaccomplished, but where I was going to be a best-selling novelist, I ended up editing trade magazines for years. You know, it was still a writing field thing, and then I did blogging and other stuff that related to using written language. But no, there are not bound volumes lined up on the bookshelf behind me with all of my author's name on them. It's not the way things went. So you have to recognize that there are going to be limits on what you can accomplish without feeling, I think, obsessed by the fact that some things are possible, some things required more effort than we wanted to give them. And of course, a lot of things just really weren't actually in alignment with true will. They were just kind of things that got spun off from true will because they were kind of sort of ways of expressing it without being perfect ways of doing it, but it still helped. Simply having to edit and write magazine, massive magazine material half a dozen times a year meant I had to tighten some of the ways I express things and think about how I would express ideas in ways that I probably wouldn't have done if I'd just been staring out the window doing a less literary style of job. So there's all of that to look at.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that comes to my mind sometimes is like I feel like I've had to just get stuck in the weeds in terms of trying to make progress at things. And even just the way that we look at like Crowley's writings about making progress at things and this sort of thing, it seems like, yeah, for some people, it just seems like things are lined up. The opportunities are there. The, you know, things are in, everything kind of aligns for their true will to find a manifestation more smoothly and easily. Whereas for some of us, it seems like we're coming out, you know, I don't know, twisted up and tangled up and having to work out all the knots. And that ends up being a big part of, you know, what we're doing with most of our lives a lot of the time.
It is, but I also think that this occasionally occurs to me when I start, getting on my own case and thinking, I could have gone a lot further. I mean, what really prevented me going straight up through knowledge and conversation, and maybe not crossing the abyss, but I could be an adeptus exemptus of AA, and et cetera, et cetera. And it's always occurred to me that part of the task is not succeeding. But particularly if you're operating within the milieu of the mystery schools, you need to be somebody who can say, yeah, I know how tough it is. I still have to deal with messy bits of me that won't behave.
Mm-hmm.
There was an upsetting weekend we had with my housemate. Her dog became very ill very suddenly, and we had to have him put down on Monday. I slept fine through the night until we put him down, and then I could not sleep for the next three nights because the whole experience overcame me. Even though we settled the issue, he can't continue. He was looking absolutely skeletal. He just looked so tired, so upset. And the vet said, it's not working. His kidneys have failed. So we had to make that call. And it was only after we'd buried him in the big backyard space we have here that it began to just, everything I've been holding in place, trying to deal with it in a responsible, conscious, caring sort of way, got to me. And if I was this perfect adept, I'd have just said, well, that was how it is, These are shadows, they pass and are done, but there is that which remains, and it's bedtime, so I'll just sleep through the night. No, I couldn't. There was just so much that was brought up about the conditions of life, the fact that people, like animals, become ill, get old, and die. I know a couple of people recently who have been dealing with severe illnesses because I'm in that age bracket where all of my friends are saying, I went to the doctor last week and he thinks, dot, dot, dot. I think perhaps the masters really do have that sort of control, the real, genuine, realized masters. Because you've got to remember, again, there's always this proviso that, you've just taken this grade. You're not altogether in that grade yet. You've got to bring all the bits of yourself into that grade experience before you are stabilized in that grade. And you may need to do that for some years.
Mm-hmm.
My first teacher once remarked that he'd gone through what I think was 3-8 AA in, a few months. And thought, 4-7 AA is just, going to be the same. And he was stuck there for 7 years because of his personality structures that just needed a lot of ironing out. And I think that's part of the initiation process, again, of learning to deal with not just getting yourself to where you want and feel you need to be, but also dealing with the fact that as human beings, we have to go through this really messy life experience. You just don't always do stuff right. And that's just the way things are. I mean, when the dog died, I thought, my housemate is not, she's not a Kabbalist, so I'll throw a quick funeral ceremony together. And, we go up, we're burying the dog. I dug a place to bury him. Well, I'd not actually checked with her what she had in mind. And, with the best of intentions, I kind of, trod on her toes. And a couple of days later, she had to say, I was kind of upset with what you did there because you just took over. And it was like, my superior wisdom here lacked the element of prior consultation. Things like that are always going to be there. And this was not something I was doing out of malice or out of a lack of concern and compassion. I wanted to be helpful. And in fact, I just, without thinking, pushed her to the side. And, that's just, sometimes you have to keep learning those things and keep on stumbling through.
Well, you know, that makes me think of a long time ago, I tried to intentionally begin paying attention to, you know, what actually works in daily life to avoid conflict or, you know, tension and this sort of thing. And so I would try to navigate that, and it, over time and consistent practice and experience, I came to realize there's nothing you can do. It's just going to happen. And it's like, you know, we can pretend that these social, you know, rules and things and are going to help us to know what's the correct thing to do and what's the incorrect thing to do and whatnot. But it's like, inevitably, you're just going to have to deal with conflict and you know, these kinds of problems that'll come up from time to time with all the best of intentions even.
Yeah, thou shalt have danger and trouble. Rahu Kuwait is with thee.
Mm-hmm.
But the two things, and you know, one does not rule out the other. You're still going to have the danger and trouble. Maybe not that much danger in the lifestyle that I've adopted, but certainly trouble, because I don't always stop to check in with everybody else. Like, you know, is what I'm doing okay? And sometimes people will say, well, all right. When they mean, no, it's not okay at all. So there's that, again, you're dealing with the intimacy of transcended initiation. You're dealing with the supernal, you're dealing with something that is completely outside of the context of ordinary human life. And that involves visions, and it involves contact with levels of consciousness or separate beings well outside of the human scale. And then there's always the sense that you are dealing with something that is absolutely at the center of you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people go on about, you know, the heart and the heart center, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it's true that that is the thing that you're actually trying to get closer into, so that Hadith is functioning right from that very center of beingness, and it's an aware process. It's an aware reaching out to others, and it's also an ability to do nothing, that which is a very hard thing to do, nothing, when we're called for.
Mm-hmm.
I always hoped I could master the art of nothing. You know, just be shut down. I did. There was a phase in my early life with the very first stuff I was doing, and I thought, well, I don't know that I've really become that spectacular a super being, but I was able to sit and just have my mind calm and clear. I never really got back to that, except intermittently with magical work. It's one of the things that's kept me in magic. You know, if I ask myself ideologically, philosophically, why magic is, well, it just happens to work for me. Mm-hmm. It's the thing that shuts my brain down, which is, you know, really nice when you can take a break from yourself.
I was just reading The Gospel According to St. Bernard Shaw by Aleister Crowley. Yeah. And I was, for the first time, reading it with actually, you know, comparing Bernard Shaw's preface to Androcles and the Lion, which is what Crowley's actually criticizing or commenting on. And so it's the first time I'm actually comparing, you know, chapter by chapter, going back and forth, so I can actually get the context for the damn thing. And yeah, there's some interesting stuff, but there's a big portion that Crowley specifically pulls out of his Tao Tien, whatever that book's called. And it's basically talking about Japanese rulership in some ancient period or something, and the idea that, well, there's these problems between the classes and whatnot, and so the advice of this ascended master is basically breaking it down to balancing everything with its opposite. So it's very much Crowley's Taoist ideas, and so, like, he uses the example of I would give a course of being prim and proper to the prostitute, and I would hope that she would end up being, you know, she would result in being a great mother and, you know, this sort of thing. And then I would give, for the prudish woman, I would give a course of hedonistic kind of sexuality in this, and I would hope that she would end up being a good mother, this sort of thing. So basically, the way I think I had put a spin on that was like, I would recommend atheism to a theist and, you know, like Satan to a Christian and these kinds of ideas so that it's like you can balance out whatever your current sort of position is on things.
Right. I doubt that a single one of those examples would actually work in real life. I know a few Christians, and I've also known a couple of women who were prostitutes. And the way I was dealt with them as individuals is not what Crowley's recommending. But who knows? He might have been right. But yeah, essentially, you have to reach that balance. Well, not a balance point, the ability to allow the pendulum to move. That I think, is one of the fictions of initiation. And I found a lot of people very early on who do quit, it's like they're hoping that immediately they'll come to a state of peace and calm. You'll somehow give them the spell, you know, that exercise or the magic word, the word of power that will just stop everything. That is a long work. And part of the work is realizing you're not going to get to the stop point all the time. You might, when you are sitting in your temple space, doing a mantra, meditating, or in the middle of a ritual, but most of the time you're just going to have to allow yourself those fluctuations from one point to the other. I think that comes back again to what I was saying about the current political situation of recognizing that there are enormous tides of emotion running around at the moment that are very upsetting, alarming, depressing, etc., etc. And allowing yourself to know those, to feel them and think, I felt that too. I'm not oblivious to it. And I'm not going to pretend that, we must all be non-attached. It doesn't work like that. You're going to feel the attachment. And until you've known the attachment and seen where the attachment lies and how it's manifesting, it's going to be tough to get yourself to a point where you can say, okay, what is happening is happening. I can only truly control my own self and maybe my own immediate environment. For the rest, I have to let things go the way they have to go.
Yeah.
And it's the really, really great initiates, the true masters, who have got to the point where they can say, black is black and white is white, and sometimes white is black. And you think, what? And you think, well, it just happens at times that you can't make a clear differentiation between what is desirable and what isn't. And that, of course, is the spiritual crisis for the master that Crowley has in La Liber Bivel Magi. You know, it warns him that you're just going to face this weird situation where any position that you take can be a valid one. You just have to deal with that and manifest it consistently while knowing that, you know, if you're preaching the word of God, you could easily be preaching the word of atheism or a Buddhist non-theism as well. And that would also be equally valid.
Mm-hmm.
And the actual truth that underlies or interpenetrates or just lies behind whichever philosophy or philosophies you're pushing is the real thing that really doesn't have much of a name and you can't identify its nature. The initiate has to come to terms with the fact that there's something that is absolutely undeniable, cannot be excluded, has to be included and cannot be identified by any set of convenient adjectives that come into your mind.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a wonderfully uplifting note for people who are trying to figure out whether Thelema's for them or not.
I think just be sure that you have the power of the devil card of mirth.
That
as you're
is
going
essential.
Through this.
Yes, the devil is a very important component of the initiative path.
Well, thanks very much, Edward. I really appreciate your time, and this is a really interesting discussion today, being able to delve into this idea of the three schools. And it's, you know, there's plenty of fruit there that's left untouched on higher branches, I'm sure.
We could probably come back to this in sometime later on and redo the whole thing with a different understanding. But anyway, thank you for being the sounding board, because as I said, I was drafting my ideas and thinking, what is it I actually want to talk about? And whatever I came to talk about is what I talked about.
It's black, it's white, and it's black and white. Exactly. It could be either.
Exactly. Yeah. There's the mystery in one sentence. If you can decode that one, you too can be a master of the paradox.
Always drink your Ovaltine? Well, thanks again, 93. Listening. Look for Toronto Thelema on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Watch for events in the city. And join us again in the darkly splendid abodes.